Case and Cure of a Deserted Soul, Part 15, Chapter 31, Second False Rule. Men think they are in this sad condition because they do less than they have done. And I say that this is indeed an ominous sign, simply considered, because all things work as they are, and I desire not to be mistaken here, for I would not be so injurious to God or cruel to men as to nourish a slothful and backsliding person in his apostasy and carelessness. But I say that it is possible that less may be done than has been done previously, yet without all loss of life. For besides that which has been said before, I add, in way of satisfaction, these considerations. Number one, perhaps that which was done before was more than should have been done. As other men are apt to fall short, so a godly man is apt to succeed, or exceed, especially when his necessities pinch him, and when the fears of God lay heavily upon his soul. He neither minds business, nor friends, nor himself, but is so intent upon this one thing as if it were the only thing which he had to mind. I have previously spoken at length of how a man may know when he has done so much that he may, with comfort, walk in his way. Number two, the abundance of doing is to rise and fall according to occasions. When a man is in straits, he may and must do much, yea, more than is required at other times. Number three, God may give less opportunity for the same abundance of holy duties at all times. He may put them upon such conditions and employments as may take them up more. A wife has a variety of obligations that attend the state of marriage, which may deprive her of some opportunities which she had when she was unmarried. There is a difference between a wife and a virgin. She that is unmarried cares for the things that belong to the Lord, and how she may please the Lord. But she that is married cares for the things of the world, how she may please her husband. 1 Corinthians 7, verse 34. The apostle does not mean that the married care not for the things of God, but that the condition will bring distractions. By God's appointment, they have put upon themselves such things that they cannot have that fullness of time for exercises of godliness which they had in a single state. In all abatements of spiritual action, a special eye must be had to the cause. If we thrust ourselves into a thicket of business unnecessarily, or have lost that edge of holy desires and dispositions which we previously had, then we have cause to lament our elongation from God. Chapter 32. Other False Rules Causing a Mistake in Judgment. False Rule Number 3. More Stirring of Corruptions. Because men feel greater workings of lusts and corruptions than before, they think that God is not with them as before. But by way of addressing these concerns, I must necessarily grant that this also is an ominous sign. Yet I will demonstrate that it may be the case of a man who is as full of God as ever. Number one, distinguish between corruptions formally considered and effectively considered. There may be many motions to sin which are not corruptions. They are corruptions when they corrupt and deprave the heart. Christ himself had motions to sin. These did not rise from within himself, but were caused by the tempter, so that his soul was as a glass of pure water jostled. And although the motions to sin which arise from that sinfulness in us are formally and in interpretation of the law, sins, yet unless they take hold of the heart and so infect it, they are not corruptions, nor such as argue less of God. When a man lives in an unhealthful and infectious air, the power of God is much seen in keeping him up in health. So also the power of the Spirit is much put forth in that soul which is kept sound from the plague in the midst of infectious and poisonous workings and foaming of that sinfulness within. This was the apostle's case. He had some burning lust like a splinter or coal in the flesh, but God kept him. My grace is sufficient for thee, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. 2 Corinthians 12, verse 9. Number two, a man may have more occasions to stir corruptions than before, and occasions to lusts are as wind to the sail, or fuel to the fire. It may be that you thought better of yourselves than you had cause to. You might think you had more meekness when you were less angry. But it may be that your anger was not so much, not because your meekness was great, but because your offenses were few. Know this, that occasions do not so much beget as bring forth corruptions. Number three, it may be that your lusts do not have more life, but they seem to, because you yourself have more life. Letter A. You had more light to see them. At first, grace is busy about the outward man and grosser sins, but afterwards it descends into the lower and more retired parts of the soul, and by the candle of God searches the hidden depths. And finding still new worlds of sin, you are apt to think that you are worse than you were before. The puddle smells when it is stirred. The sun shows a great deal of dust in the air, which you knew was there before, even though you had not seen it before, when the sun shone not so brightly upon it. Letter B. You have more sense. When there was but little life, many lusts might work unfelt, but now every touch of sin is felt. Therefore you may think it amiss, and that you have more of corruptions, when indeed the cause is not the increase of sin, but of grace. The apostle made nothing of lustings and many other things till grace had incorporated itself and made him quick to feel the bitter and stinging workings of it. Romans 7:21-25. Number four, it may be that your life has been in a continual tumult and warfare with great afflictions of body and mind, so that corruptions had no time to work. But now, being brought to a greater calm, they begin to stir. In a tempestuous day, the birds hide themselves in the hedges, and the conies in their holes, a coney being a rabbit. But when the storms have passed, then they come forth. While Rome was held in wars, and while the Athenians were buffeted by the Lacedaemonians, their own dissensions and internal evils lay asleep. But when they had rest, then that which lay hidden broke forth to their great hurt. Men who are heavy laden with weighty concerns, living in crowds of affairs, or distracted with great cares and fears, are free from many vices in their lives, which break out when they have more liberty. Consider carefully if there has not been some eminent change in your conditions, for a calm state is subject to many inconveniences of this kind, because lusts have more life, but because they have more advantage. Number five, God may permit Satan to work in men and allow their corruptions to be drawn out so that they may be more mortified. We take up arms and fight much when we see our enemy coming upon us. If the enemy had kept in his trenches and holds, he would have been safe. But by coming out, he falls into our hands. The rats and mice are secure in their holes, but when they show themselves by coming out, they are taken and killed. Therefore, when the snuffed-out candle, that you thought was extinguished, smells and begins to burn again, it is then that you may make super work in more fully extinguishing it. False rule number four. Men are too much swayed by the opinion which others have of them. If they are censured or rejected or discountenanced by such, it makes deep impressions upon them, especially if they are near, beloved, wise, godly, or such as know them. There is a disposition in man to be much affected with the judgment which he knows others to make of him. Hence come those inquirers into others' breasts, to see what shape we hold in their mirrors, even as the emperor acted himself dead, and caused his funeral to be solemnly performed, his hearse erected, his followers clad in mourning, and himself carried as a dead corpse, while in the meantime, through a secret passage, he might observe what respect he had in his subjects' hearts. Hence also arise suspicious and secret dejectments of mind, upon conjecture of disesteem and the disapproval of others. Hence also vain glorying and supercilious elation of mind upon the applause and fame which men have with others. And indeed, to be approved by wise and good men is both desirable and honorable. The concurrence of their testimony is a glorious thing. For the same reason, the disfavor and ill opinion of such to an ingenuous spirit is an unhappiness. But sometimes there's too much weight laid on these things. If the opinion and judgment of others were infallible, reason would require that we should mold our thoughts of ourselves to the model of other men's opinions. But others are not always competent and sufficient judges in this case. Therefore, as their sentence is not to be wholly neglected or completely neglected, so it is not to be too much valued. God sometimes reveals his displeasure by stirring up his servants against men, such as when the master of the family will estrange himself from one. He bids his children and servants to show him no countenance. If this is your case, you should humbly and wisely consider it, and say as David when Shimei reviled him, "The Lord hath bidden him." 2 Samuel 16, verse 11. Consider yourselves, and rest no way in the sentence which men give, but appeal from them to the Supreme Judge, studying to approve yourselves to God, for he is a Jew which is one inwardly, whose praise is not of men, but of God. Romans 2, verse 29. False rule number 5. Men think they are not growing, and hence conclude sadly against themselves. They think the time has been when they arrived or when they thrived more in grace, and that therefore they are in this deplorable state of which we speak. But here may be great mistakes, and for the relief of such, let me propound some considerations tending to the rectifying of their judgment in this case. Number 1. To the weak spirits. The growth in some graces sometimes hinders the discerning of growth in others. Besides that spiritual poverty and humility which I have spoken of, the increase of light proves sometimes an impediment. Letter A. The more light, the more weight lies upon the soul concerning the matters of eternity, which sometimes raises up care and solicitousness to such a height that a man is disposed to fear and jealousy concerning his condition. Letter B. The more light, the more duties are discovered. A Christian does not see all of his work at first. God raises up his way to his eye by degrees, even as a child is put at first to such things as are proportionate to his age and strength. And as he grows in years to more capacity and ability, so he is put on to greater things. Thus the godly, finding still a disproportion in their strength to their work, may think that they are not growing. And yet this would be as if one took the measure of his height against a tree, and coming afterwards to measure his growth, found not only that he does not exceed, but scarcely reaches his own mark, should rightly conclude that he has not grown. Yet this is not good reasoning, because the tree has also grown. It is also as if one that tries his strength by shaking a tree when it is young comes some years later, and upon trial finds that he cannot stir the tree more. If he should conclude that he has not increased in strength, he would have judged amiss, not considering that the tree has also grown more sturdy and less apt to be moved. The task of a godly man grows. His relations, state, temper, calling, company, temptations, and such, like things, cause great variations in his work. And God uses a gracious indulgence in not imposing so much in the infancy as in the progress of his people. And as many things are not imposed at first, so the spirituality and exactness of duties is more and more revealed. And hence it is that the godly, laboring still with weakness and disproportion of strength, do sometimes think, though carelessly, that they grow not. Number 2. There are different types of growth. Letter A. There is growth upward, in hope, peace, and joy. Letter B, there is growth downward as a tree that grows in the root. Thus, many grow in humility and lowliness, and therefore, as I have showed, they are apt to think meanly, yea, meaner of themselves, than is appropriate. Letter C, there is growth in bulk, as when a tree grows larger. Letter D, there is growth in maturity. A child may grow a great deal more in bulk and quantity than in ripeness and dexterity, but afterward he grows more in the perfection of his parts than in the extension of those parts. He grows more strong, active, apprehensive, and wise. So a godly man grows. At first he is much in the bulk of knowledge and grace, but after this he becomes more mature, knowing the things which he has learned better, more practically and vitally, and thus he becomes able to do what he did more spiritually and perfectly. An apple grows larger and larger for a time, but afterward it grows more ripe and sweet. Now men who do not understand this are apt to think that they grow not, when in fact they do. Number 3. Men often mistake in the judgment of their growth by being too hasty. The judgment of growth is by comparing oneself with oneself. But if a man measures himself today, and a week hence measures again, his growth, though it is real, will be imperceptible. When you compare yourselves with yourselves, if you find no growth, then you look upon yourselves at a greater distance. If you cannot discern growth by comparing yourselves with what you were a year ago, then see what you were 2 years, or 3 years, or even 7 years ago. And now tell me if you find not yourselves better, if not sensibly increased in bulk, yet at least in maturity and spiritualness of your graces. Number 4. Growth is not always equal. Sometimes a child shoots up more in 1 year than afterward in 2 or 3 years. So also grace grows not so fast at some times than at other times. In the body, growth may be hindered by diseases, wounds, obstructions, or poor diet. So also in spiritual growth. But in cases, a man must take heed of concluding that God has deserted him, for, as I have said before, it is not every fit of unproficiency which argues a man is in such a state. Yea, all things considered, it may be that although growth in times past exceeds the present growth, yet a man, considering the abatement of means of growth, with other strong impediments of growth, that man may have as full a presence of God with him, though he for a time grows not as he did. Therefore, do not be hasty in passing sentence. For as many have declined, but knew it not because of slackness and slowness of judgment of themselves, so others, by hastiness in judgment, conclude they are deserted when they are not. Chapter 33. To those who have their comforts removed, the nature of the comforts of the soul. Now I come to the other head of spiritual desertions, the eclipsing of the comfort of the soul. This is oftentimes the sad case of the saints. The sons of peace and consolation are often men of sorrows, cast from a paradise of comfort into a wilderness of discomfort, wandering in a maze of perplexed thoughts, heavy care, afflicting fears, and bitter sorrows, being vexed with roarings and yellings of devouring beasts, yea, rent and wounded, and almost becoming a prey unto them. Before I come to address this mournful state in which the sweet streams of comfort fail, leaving the soul as a parched heath, I must premise some considerations about the comfort of the soul. The nature of it, chapter 33, the cause of it, chapter 34, and the defects of it, chapter 35. First, the nature of it. It is cheeriness or satisfaction of the soul. The name shows the thing. Comfort is from a word which imports strength. And what is comfort but strengthening of the heart? It is expressed by strengthening in the Scriptures. Psalm 27, verse 14. Psalm 52, verse 7, Psalm 104, verse 15, 1 Samuel 23, verse 16, Job 4, verse 4, Isaiah 35, verse 3. So then, discomfort is the enfeebling or weakening of the soul, so that it cannot walk in its way, but falls and faints. But comfort keeps her upon the wing, and maintains, yea, increases her strength. It is the life of the soul. So when Naomi would express that Boaz should be a comfort to Ruth, she said, "He shall be the restorer of thy life," Ruth 4, verse 15. For take away the contentment of the heart, and it dies. The damned live in hell, yet because it is a life without comfort, they are said to die, and their estate is reckoned a state of death. They are dead while they live. Hence David called it a quickening. Thy word hath quickened me, Psalm 119, verses 50 and 93. Restoring of comfort to mourners is called reviving. I dwell with them to revive the spirit of the humble and to revive the heart of the contrite ones, Isaiah 57, verse 15. So it is said of Jacob when he heard of his son and saw the wagons which he had sent. The spirit of Jacob, their father, revived, Genesis 45, verse 27. Those words of Ezra are not unlike, "Grace hath been revived, that our God might lighten our eyes and give us a little reviving in our bondage," Ezra 9, verse 8. Comfort, in a word, is that strength of life which the object contributes to the heart. There is then a difference of comfort, according to the difference of objects. Every good thing which a man has, either in expectation or possession, yields a comfort proportionate to its worth and a man's portion in it. All good things in the world are as the fence of the soul, or her fort against invasions of fear, care, trouble, or misery. So that as he that has the best guard, strong and able soldiers, is strongest and safest, so the heart is so much strengthened as it has of good. The best things yield the best comfort, as the freest fountain yields the fullest streams. But forasmuch not only the property of the object, but the portion also is the measure of comfort. Therefore, according to the degrees of enjoyment of God, so are the degrees of comfort. Those in heaven, being fully possessed of God, have a fullness of comfort. In thy presence is fullness of joy, Psalm 16, verse 11. But the saints in the world have but an imperfect comfort. Number one, their comfort is not stable. Sometimes it is gone, and a day of gladness is turned into a night of heaviness, so that they complain as the church. The joy of our heart is ceased, our dance is turned into mourning, Lamentations 5, verse 15. Number two, their comfort is not full. It is mixed with various fears and sorrows, which, like the waters of Marah, flow into the soul. For though the object of comfort is sufficient, yet the assurance and enjoyment of it is deficient. Even as the soul is comforted because it has God in a measure, so it is troubled because it is still lacking, not being so sure and full of Him as it desires. There are three degrees of spiritual comfort. Letter A, peace. When a man agrees with himself and is freed from that war and combustion which was within him by incursion of fears and terrors of the soul, this is a rest in the soul. A rest, I say, but not from motion, but from commotion and tumult. An uncomfortable state is a tumultuous state. My bowels boiled and rested not, Job 30, verse 27. He was like the sea, moving and working. It is a tempestuous condition. O thou afflicted, tossed with tempest and not comforted, Isaiah 54, verse 11. Comfort is the quieting of the storm, the hushing of the winds, the stilling of the raging sea. When a man has comfort in God, he has a twofold rest, bracket number one, mental. While God is hidden, the mind is agitated and rolls to and fro to seek Him, hunting and beating itself out and running after Him. But when it does see him, then it is quieted, and says as David, "Return to thy rest, O my soul," Psalm 116, verse 7. Bracket number 2, emotional. The heart sits in heaviness until it recovers what it has lost. Unquietness abides with it. If the mind is puzzled, the heart is troubled. If the pilot is disconsolate, how are the passengers afflicted? What tears, what paleness, what ringing, what fainting may one see there? What sighing, crying, howling, and screeching may one hear? In such a troubled case is the heart when God hides himself and will not be found, like Rachel weeping for her children and will not be comforted because they are not, Jeremiah 31, verse 15. But when the soul sees God, then it is quiet. The cries of the heart are stilled. Her wound is healed. Her pain ceases, and all is calm. Letter B, joy. This is a higher degree of comfort. Peace is negative comfort, while joy is positive comfort. The former is a cessation or mitigation of trouble, but this is a higher contentment. Peace is like the quieting of the storm, but joy is like the breaking out of the sun. A woman in childbirth, when the pain ceases, is at rest, but when a child is born, she has joy. A condemned man, when he is pardoned, is at peace. His fears and sorrows cease. But if, with his pardon, he attains preferment, he rejoices. There is a kind of joy in peace, and so joy is the fruit of peace and rest. I'll say that again. Joy is the fruit of peace and rest. And yet it is a further contentment than mere peace. Sorrow is turned into joy, John 16, verse 21, but first it is turned into peace. Joy is the noontide of comfort, and peace is the morning. Peace is a return to itself after it has been tossed and driven from its desired state, but joy is an ascent above itself. Peace is a rest within itself, while joy carries the heart higher. It is a kind of elation which, if it is strong, it is called exaltation, a kind of vaulting and leaping of the mind, yea, a leaping out of itself. Not the kind of leaping and joy and stuff that you find in the profane church with the rock bands and the kids jumping up and down and people singing and clapping and all of that. That's not the kind of joy that Simmons is talking about here. Peace is contentment when the heart is bounded by its condition and is not effused and poured out of its own channel, as the river is when the channel is too scant or not passable. But joy is an enlargement of the heart, Psalm 119, verse 32. The heart opens itself and is filled with the thing that it loves. Letter C, triumph and glorying, which is joy elevated. This consists of two things. Bracket number 1. A victoriousness and magnanimous conquest of the heart over all things. When the heart is raised to this pitch of comfort in God, all the world is brought under a man, and the greatest evils cannot daunt. There is such a graduation as we speak of in Romans chapter 5. We have peace towards God, verse 1. We rejoice in hope, verse 2, and not only so, but we glory in tribulation also, verse 3. Bracket number 2. A boasting and holy vaunting of heart. The word which is used by the apostle for glorying imports a jutting out or strutting of the neck. It is often used by the apostle for boastings, 2 Corinthians 9, verse 2, 2 Corinthians 10, verse 8. Romans 2, verses 17 and 23, and Romans 11, verse 18. A man boasts when he is full of that which he thinks excellent, adding worth and excellency to him. When a man counts it not only happiness, but honor to have such a God, and is not only not ashamed of him, but in his account magnified by him. When he is able to hold up his spirit against the proffers and terrors of the world to profess heaven and earth, amidst all the blasphemies, jealousies, threats, sufferings, and vainglory which are in the world, that God is good, sufficient, and worthy of all love, fear, and trust. I'll read that again. God is good, sufficient, and worthy of all love, fear, and trust. I say, when the heart comes with such undauntedness and full contentment and sets God against all, this is a holy boasting of God, or in God, even as David declared, I will bless the Lord at all times. His peace shall be continually in my mouth. My soul shall make her boast in the Lord. Psalm 34, verse 2. In God we boast all the day long and praise thy name forever. Psalm 44, verse 8, and Psalm 64, verse 10.